Penguin Random House Audio presents The League of Gentlewomen Witches by India Holton, read for you by Elizabeth Nolden. For All the Wild Wind Girls. Chapter 1. Tea and sandwiches, what the dickens, an indecorous melee, our heroine sets forth, explosions, the perils of charity, interesting footwear, Elizabeth Bennet is not consulted, a bad decision. Charlotte could listen no more in silence. For several minutes now, a young man at the tea house counter had been abusing a waiter with language that pierced her soul. She had tried to behave as the other customers and look away. After all, who did not understand the pain of being disappointed in one's hopes for a warm currant scone? But finally her patience broke, and she simply had to speak by such means as were within her reach, namely, a volume of Dickens she had been reading over tea and sandwiches. Rising from her chair, she cast great expectations at the young man's head and then settled down once more to her luncheon. The young man roared. Clutching his head, eyes blazing, he glared around the cafeteria. Who did that? Charlotte raised one delicate, lace-gloved hand. He did, she said, pointing to a dark-haired gentleman at a nearby table. Several ladies gasped. Her chosen scapegoat, however, gave no reaction. Charlotte was unsurprised. She had seen him enter the tea house earlier, and noted at a glance how everything about him was rich, from his long black overcoat to his gold-handled briefcase. She could not imagine him paying attention to anyone he might consider lesser than himself. Indeed, he read his newspaper and drank his coffee as if she had not even spoken. The angry young man had heard her well enough, however. He stormed across to snatch the gentleman's newspaper and fling it dramatically to the ground. The moment was rather spoiled by paper sheets fluttering about, one covering his face and thereby muting his tirade, but he pulled it away, scrunching it within a fist. What do you think you're doing? He demanded, brandishing his knuckles along with the rumpled paper. The gentleman blinked composedly. I beg your pardon? You throw a book at me! Stand up, mister, and face justice! Don't be ridiculous, the gentleman replied, unmoved. Charlotte noted that his voice was rich, too, with a slight accent woven through like gold thread. Compensate me for my newspaper, then return to whatever gutter from which you crawled. You are disturbing the peace. I'll give you disturbing! The young man grasped the coat lapels of the older and hauled him from his chair. Goodness me, Charlotte murmured, leaning back as the men stumbled against her table. Screams arose from the other patrons, but Charlotte did not indulge in shock. Her teacup was rattling in its saucer. Her sandwiches almost leaped off their plate. If she sat around gasping, luncheon would be entirely spoiled. With a sigh, she stood, laying her napkin on the table. She took a last sip of tea while the men knocked over chairs with their furious wrestling. She wrapped her sandwiches in the napkin, rescued her purse from the table moments before the men crashed onto it, then left the tea house, picking up the gentleman's briefcase as she went. A tiny bell tinkled as she opened the door and stepped out. A breeze plucked at her strawberry blonde coiffure, but was unable to disrupt it. Charlotte paused, squinting against the lambent afternoon light, and considered her route ahead. St. James's Street was busy as usual, with a bright drift of ladies going about their regular business, shopping and sightseeing, and generally making a promenade of themselves. A woman dressed simply in grey, with only one feather on her hat, and the smallest bustle possible without being indecent, would stand out most regrettably amongst them. But there was no choice. She closed the shop door just as a teapot smashed against it. From within the premises came a lady's anguished cry, and then a man shouted, "Where is my briefcase?" Charlotte straightened her modest hat, hung her purse from the crook of her elbow, and proceeded along the street. She had not gone far when the tinkle of a doorbell shook through her consciousness. Without glancing back, she began to lengthen her stride. She managed to cover several yards of St. James's Street within moments, and, nodding to acknowledge a police constable who veered in his path to make way for her, turned onto King Street. Almost at once, she found herself stalled by a half dozen ladies laughing together as they moved at a rate that barely qualified as strolling. Charlotte managed to tap her foot impatiently, even as she edged forward behind them. "Stop! Thief!" arose a shout from St. James's Street, the force of its anger making it clearly audible despite the distance. Charlotte attempted to circumnavigate the ladies without success. Really, people had no consideration for others these days. How was one supposed to effect a robbery when dawdlers blocked the footpath in this disgraceful manner? They left her no option but to cast off all decorum and step out amongst the wagons on the road. A driver hollered at her to immediately evacuate his intended route, or at least words to that effect. As she looked back, Charlotte saw the gentleman from the tea house enter King Street, his coat billowing as he strode toward her. Realizing that she would not be able to outpace him, she muttered under her breath. All of a sudden, the wagon's horses whinnied and reared, forcing their vehicle to a shuddering stop in the center of the road. Pumpkins flew from the back, bursting open on the cobblestones and causing ladies to scream as orange mush splattered over their gowns. A phaeton coming up behind narrowly avoided collision, and as its driver rose from his seat to shout abuse at the wagoner, various pedestrians rushed to join in. Within seconds, the street was blocked. Charlotte walked away from the tumult, her heels clicking delicately against the paving. Noticing Almack's public assembly house farther along, she began to aim for it. A policeman's whistle pierced the clamor of the crowd, and Charlotte winced. Pain from the noise ricocheted along her nerves. If only she could leave London with all its cacophony and retire to Hampshire, birthplace of Jane Austen, where green peace whispered wild yet gentle poetry to one's heart. It was never to be. Duty forced her presence in London, noble duty, and the fact there was not much of value to steal in the countryside. Yet still she dreamed. And occasionally took brief jaunts by train because, truly, there was nothing like leaving home for real comfort. Thus, imagining oak trees and country lanes, while behind her the brawl intensified, Charlotte made her way without further impediment toward Almack's. Its door stood open, a delivery boy's bicycle leaning on the wall beside it, and the warm interior shadows promised respite from London's inconveniences, as well as a back door through which she could slip unnoticed by policemen, pumpkin carters, and aggravated briefcase owners. She was almost there when she saw the child. A mere scrap of humanity, he huddled within torn and filthy clothes, his small hand extended pathetically. Charlotte looked at him, and then at Almack's door. She came to a decisive stop. "Hello," she said, in the stiff tones of someone unused to conversing with children. "Are you hungry?" The urchin nodded. Charlotte offered him her wrapped sandwiches, but he hesitated, his eyes growing wide and fearful as he glanced over her shoulder. Suddenly, he snatched the food and ran. Charlotte watched him go. Two cucumber sandwiches would not sustain a boy for long, but no doubt he could sell the linen napkin to good effect. She almost smiled at the thought. Then she drew herself up to her fullest height, lifted her chin, and turned to look at the gentleman now looming over her. "Good afternoon," she said, tightening her grip on his briefcase. In reply, he caught her arm lest she follow the example of the urchin. His expression tumbled through surprise and uncertainty before landing on the hard ground of displeasure. His dark blue eyes smoldered. For the first time, Charlotte noticed he wore high leather boots, strapped and buckled, scarred from interesting use, boots to make a woman's heart tremble, either in trepidation or delight, depending on her education. A silver hook hung from his left ear, a ruby ring encircled one thumb, and what she had taken for a beard was mere unshaven stubble. Altogether, it led to a conclusion Charlotte was appalled not to have reached earlier. Pirate, she said in disgust. Thief, he retorted. Give me back my briefcase. How rude, not even the suggestion of a please. But what else could one expect from a barbarian, who probably flew around in some brick cottage, thinking himself a great man just because he could get it up? Pirates really were the lowest of the low, even if, or possibly because, they could go higher than everyone else in their magic-raised battle-houses. Such an unsubtle use of enchantment was a crime against civilization, even before one counted in the piracy. Charlotte allowed her irritation to show, although frowning on the street was dreadfully unladylike. Possession is 9/10 of the law, sir. Kindly unhand me, and I will not summon a police officer to charge you with molestation. He surprised her by laughing. I see you are a wit as well as a thief, and an unlikely philanthropist, too. If you hadn't stopped for the boy, you might have gotten away. I still shall. I don't think so. You may be clever, but I could have you on the ground in an instant. You could, Charlotte agreed placidly. However, you may like to note that my shoe is pressed against your foot. If I am so inclined, I can release a poisoned dart from its heel, which will penetrate boot and skin to paralyze you within moments. He raised an eyebrow. Ingenious. So you, too, are a pirate, I take it. Charlotte gasped, trying to tug her arm from his grip. I most certainly am not, sir, and I demand an apology for the insult. He shrugged. Charlotte waited, but apparently that was the extent of his reply. She drew a tight breath, determined to remain calm. What would Jane Austen's fiercest heroine, Elizabeth Bennet, do in this situation? I consider myself a reasonable woman, she said. I take pride in not being prejudiced. Although your behaviour is disgraceful, and I shall surely have bruises on my arm, I do appreciate this has been a difficult afternoon for you. Therefore, I give you permission to withdraw. How kind, he said wryly, although he did ease his grip on her arm. I am going nowhere, however, without my briefcase. But it is for the orphans, she said, her tone suggesting horror that he would deprive the poor, wretched creatures of whatever small comfort his briefcase might afford them. The orphans, indeed. And you're taking it to them right now? To be ridiculous, it's afternoon. No well-mannered lady does business in the afternoon. I'm taking it home, selling its contents, and adding the income to my estate. It will support my general affluence and prestige, which in turn will lend weight to my opinion about the sad plight of orphans. I see. So by contributing to your personal wealth, I am helping the poor. Exactly. He grinned. You sure you're not a pirate? Certainly not. I am the opposite of a pirate. I am a good person. I only steal from the rich. And those who would be rich if they just put their minds to it? Yes. She paused, frowning. No, that is... She broke off, muttering. I beg your pardon, the man asked, then flinched as a pumpkin flew past his head, narrowly missing him before exploding against the wall of Almack's. Wet pulp splashed his coat, although by good fortune and some reversal of the laws of physics, none touched Charlotte. The man regarded her steadily for a long moment. Then with his free hand, he pulled back her sleeve to reveal a delicate gold bracelet set with tiny jeweled bee charms. I thought so. I've heard of women like you. What is your name? Charlotte tried again to escape his grip, without success. Very well, she relented. I am Miss Anne Smith. And whom do I have the misfortune of addressing? Captain Alex O'Reilly, madam, which, may I add, is my real name. So he was Irish, as suggested by his mild accent. An Irish pirate in London. Charlotte could only imagine the unbridled poetry he was leaving in his wake. I cannot say I am pleased to meet you, Mr. O'Reilly, but if you leave me your card, I'm sure I'll acknowledge the acquaintance should we happen to encounter each other again at some public ball or soiree. Or, he countered, I could just knock you unconscious, take back my briefcase, and kiss you before I leave. He smiled wickedly. Charlotte almost gasped for the second time in 21 years. Her outrage was so great, she struggled to summon a witty retort. Elizabeth Bennet, consulted urgently, could only suggest that his arrogance, his conceit, and his selfish disdain of the feelings of others were such as to bypass her disapprobation and move straight to dislike. But Charlotte did not have time to express all that before he spoke again. Forgive me, he said, without the slightest evidence of remorse. I'm not usually quite so rough. But what else can a pirate do when he meets a lady of the Wiccan League? He gave her a smug, challenging look. I have no idea what you mean, Charlotte replied. No. He tipped his head to one side as if he might see her better crooked. I once knew a lady with a similar bracelet featuring bees. It is a common symbol. For her, it showed she belonged to a covert league of women skilled in the cunning arts. That is to say, although I believe it must never be said. Glancing around to be sure no one could hear him, he leaned so close Charlotte could see the sparks of mockery in his eyes. Witchcraft. Charlotte considered this for a moment, then discarding Elizabeth Bennet in favor of Lydia, she stomped down hard on his foot. Purple smoke burst from her heel. Bother! Wrong shoes! The churl might sicken if he breathed in that smoke, but since it was some 6 feet below his mouth and nose, the risk of even that was minimal. She herself was in more danger, being shorter than him. Luckily, surprise had caused him to weaken his grip, and Charlotte yanked free, bashed him in the gut, then under the chin with his own briefcase, and made a run for it. Stop, he shouted, but did not follow, on account of being hunched over, clutching at his stomach. Charlotte knew, however, that he'd soon recover and catch up to her. Escaping on foot was going to be impossible. Almost without thinking, she grabbed hold of the delivery boy's bicycle and clambered on as quickly as her skirts would allow. The machine wobbled as she began to ride it across the cobblestones. She spoke rushed words under her breath. A lady hurried out of her way. A cry could be heard from what she guessed was the delivery boy, and she went on urgently muttering, until all at once the bicycle lifted from the footpath into the sunlit air. Alex grinned through his pain as he watched the witch take flight. Pedestrians were gasping and pointing at the sight of a woman on an airborne bicycle, or perhaps because her lace drawers were made visible by the billowing of her skirts. She really was rather magnificent, he conceded, with her rich strawberry blonde hair and her eyes like tornado weather, not to mention her delightful willingness to maim or kill him. Her manner, though, reminded Alex a little too much of his childhood nurse. The thought of kissing her, mingled with the recollection of Nanny smacking his bottom, made a man more flustered than he wanted to be on a public street. Besides, Alex disliked witches on general principle. While he'd only ever known one before, that had been one more than enough. Even the memory of her made him wince, and he hastily transformed the expression into a brooding scowl, in case someone was watching. The Wisteria Society, leaders of the pirate community, considered witchcraft déclassé, and Alex tended to agree with them, although he preferred devious, destructive, and other alliterative words he could not think up just at that moment. Although the Wiccan League employed the same magical incantation as pirates, they chose to do so subtly. Alex found this suspicious. What kind of person preferred to trifle with minor things, pumpkins, people, bicycles, when they could fly actual buildings? And why do it secretly, when infamy was possible? On the other hand, he also agreed with the witches when they called pirates unjustifiably arrogant. He himself was entirely justified in his arrogance, but some pirates he knew could benefit from the Wiccan League's assessment. Not that such a thing would ever happen, since the two societies took such mutual pleasure from hating each other that they never willingly met. Alex would not have chased the woman today had he realized she belonged to the League. He might be a nefarious privateer, but he did not generally ask for trouble. Mind you, the witch was the one heading for trouble now. Flying a bicycle over a crowded street was rather inconducive to the League's precious secrecy, and when her fellow witches learned about it, she was going to be in more danger than she ever would have been with him. At the thought, he smiled and waved up to her. Losing his briefcase was a nuisance, for he'd come up to town for a spot of blackmailing, maybe a swindle or two, and her robbery had mucked that up. But mostly, he just felt glad to see her go. Never mind that he could still smell her enticingly puritanical scent of plain soap, nor that his foot was throbbing from her impact on him. Alex respected women enough to know when to keep the hell away from them. But goodness, those certainly were very pretty drawers. Charlotte frowned as she pedaled upward. All her life she had been bound by one rule. Well, that is to say, several dozen rules, such as never put the milk in before the tea, never slouch on the sofa, and always brush one's hair 100 times before bed. But beneath the petty requirements that governed women's existence, there was one particular to the circumstances of a witch. Never do magic in public. Oh, she might fling a book and make it seem that she'd used her hand to do so. She might stop a wagon, toss its produce to create a diversion. But obvious magic, that was strictly forbidden. Not only might she be burned alive if caught, but she endangered the entire League. Just because no one had encountered a witch hunter in more than a century didn't mean they weren't out there, stalking the streets and haunting the nightmares of decent, law-breaking witches. Charlotte had been raised better than to break a rule, take a risk. And certainly Elizabeth Bennet would never do it. Yet here she was, riding a bicycle above a busy London street at noon, while a crowd of pedestrians stared up at her in horrified amazement. Stupid, Charlotte castigated herself. Some man grabs your arm, smiles at you like he's slowly unlacing your brain, and you panic and throw 21 years of scrupulous caution to the winds. Literally. The briefcase's contents had better prove worth it. Her hat feather fluttered in the breeze as if from memory. Her skirts billowed around her knees. Charlotte pedaled hard to gain height. If she could just surmount the rooftops, she'd be away free. Unable to resist an anxious glance down at the street, she saw Captain O'Reilly waving cheerfully to her. There was something in his hand. Bother! He'd stolen her purse! Odious churl, she shouted, and shook the briefcase at him. He laughed. The bicycle wavered perilously, and as Charlotte tried to grip its handlebars with both hands, the briefcase's latch snapped. Before she could do anything, it tipped open. And shredded blank paper floated down on the crowd. Chapter 2. Miss Plym disapproves. The past and the future. A dull tale in which nothing unusual happened. News. An acrobatic butler. More news. The race is on. It is a truth seldom acknowledged that a single woman in possession of a good fortune is not especially in want of a husband. Miss Judith Plym, socially advantaged and possessing several fortunes, although legally they belonged to other people, had always felt a man would add nothing to her happiness. As she grew older, and the world offered no opportunity for her to test this theory, she became so determined in it that she assumed the same must be true for any woman. "Just consider poor Hadassah Greig," she said to her sister, Mrs. Pettifer, as they sipped tea at a lace-covered table in the Pettifer drawing room. "Marriage has ruined her health. Why, she's only been a bride 3 weeks and is practically bedridden." Mrs. Pettifer replied. She flicked over a page in the magazine she had open on her lap. Miss Plym eyed her narrowly through a small, round pair of spectacles. Are you listening to me, Delphine? Of course not, dear. Mrs. Pettifer held out her hand without looking up from the magazine, and with a low mutter, transported a biscuit from a nearby plate to her fingers. But don't let that stop you from going on. Miss Plym pursed her lips in lieu of employing the witch's incantation to propel Mrs. Pettifer out the nearest window. Magic was not to be used for fun. Miss Plym was very clear on that. So clear, indeed, that she had made it the unofficial motto of the Wiccan League by dint of sheer nagging. She was a stickler. Not for anything in particular, per se, but rather for everything. If there was stickling to be done, Miss Plym was the woman for the job. And nothing called for stickling more than witchcraft. What are you reading in that rag that could be more important than the willful self-ruin of independent women? She demanded of her sister. An account of the Belfast riots, Mrs. Pettifer said. This was, it must be said, an awfully brief statement on the Irish situation from a woman who had recently used witchcraft to campaign against that atrocious liberal, Gladstone, driving him so to distraction by subtly moving the pencil tray on his desk and the potted fern on his windowsill that he actually proposed home rule for the Irish and got himself laughed out of office. Several people have been killed, Mrs. Pettifer reported. It's quite shocking. Miss Plym pecked irritably at her tea. Something more shocking happened yesterday. Indeed? Mrs. Pettifer flicked over another page. You smiled at someone? No. I was in Twinings, and that Darlington woman walked in. She acknowledged me politely with a nod. At this, Mrs. Pettifer finally looked up, her velvety eyes growing wide. Not Miss Darlington, the pirate. Indeed, Miss Plym intoned. How atrocious! What did you do? Arranged for a canister of tea to fall on her head, of course. What else could I do? Nothing, Mrs. Pettifer agreed. And how did she respond? Brace yourself, sister. I am braced, sister. Tell me. She laughed. Mrs. Pettifer, despite the bracing, gasped. This never would have happened a few months ago, Miss Plym said, shaking her head as she recollected the offensive scene. The knot of black hair upon her crown reverberated with an attitude of disapproval all its own. Apparently, the woman has got herself married to some man, and it's caused her to develop a sense of humour. These last three words were spoken as if they tasted of raw lemon rind. Married in her advanced years, and moreover, when she is independently wealthy. Women should only become wives if they have nothing better to do. Granted, Darlington is a pirate, therefore prone to stupid behaviour. But altogether, this modern trend for romance is quite ridiculous. Mrs. Pettifer said, trying not to glance at the dozen red roses her husband had given her yesterday. They stood in a vase just behind her older sister's head, making the thin, grey-clad woman appear to be wreathed with folly. If only she knew how Mrs. Pettifer had expressed gratitude to Mr. Pettifer for those roses. All at once, Mrs. Pettifer was obliged to repurpose the magazine as a fan. I blame education, Miss Plym was saying, oblivious to her sister's blushes. The female brain is weakened with all those ramblings from male philosophers and foolish examples from kings. With a click of her tongue, she damned the entire compass of pedagogical arts, selected a tiny salmon sandwich from the tiered plate before her, then muttered a few words to engage the teapot in refilling her cup, while she herself cut the sandwich into quarters. At least our Charlotte seems established as an old maid. My Charlotte, Mrs. Pettifer amended, since the girl in question was her daughter. Don't talk nonsense, Delphine. Miss Plym lifted the sandwich to her lips, then lowered it again with an expression of vague revulsion. You know that, as the prophesied one, Charlotte belongs to the entire Wiccan League. In other words, herself. She was, after all, as its leader, the very embodiment of the League. Or the archetype. Or whatever noun necessary to justify Charlotte being in her control. Mrs. Pettifer gave a sigh as complex as her tightly curled coiffure. Don't mention that prophecy. I still maintain Lettuce just wanted to predict smaller bustles and higher hemlines. Balderdash, I heard her. You dictated to her. And she clearly said the true heir of Beryl Black would come, bringing in a new era of greatness. Then she pointed at you. 7 months later, Charlotte was born. Mrs. Pettifer recalled the scene with distaste. It had quite ruined her wedding day. The fact Lettuce had died later that night only served to further inspire general belief in her prediction, mostly because the League witches knew a warning not to ask questions when they saw one in the form of a knife having accidentally fallen into the back of an elderly woman while she slept. Then again, scandal would have erupted had Charlotte not been prophesied somehow. Witches disliked seeing people go about their lives in random fashion. It was altogether untidy. Why, only yesterday, Mrs. Pettifer herself had been predicted by various cards, crystals, and passing clouds to spend the week playing tennis, buying that charming pink hat in Harrods, and alas, having afternoon tea with Judith. Lettuce could at least have waited until I was on my honeymoon to announce her prophecy, she said, with a bitter look at her sister. Miss Plym would have shrugged had that not been unladylike, and rather difficult to do when one's posture is even stiffer than an Englishman's upper lip. There was no time to waste. Rumour had it Margaret Cuttle was about to pay a medium to predict her granddaughter was the one. Can you imagine anything so unscrupulous? Mrs. Pettifer thought of Lettuce's body in its blood-soaked bed and decided changing the subject was advisable. If you feared Charlotte marrying, she said, why did you insist on her receiving such a thorough education? The risk was necessary. Even if she weren't the prophesied one, Charlotte is a Plym and therefore needed to be educated with her heritage in mind. Plym women had been witches for almost 200 years, although this did not equate to a blood inheritance of magic. Their power came from a Latin incantation Beryl Black had found in an old sea-washed bottle while digging a grave for her husband on the island where he'd shipwrecked them. He asked her what the bottle was. She told him to go back to sleep. After Beryl realized the incantation could move any object, regardless of weight, she used it to fly a local's hut back to England, where she shared her tale with the ladies in her book club. Thus, the Wiccan League was born. And a subgroup of lesser importance, comprising ladies whose book club contributions had involved drinking too much wine and reading aloud lurid scenes from penny dreadful novels. They degraded the art of witchery into the crude practice of flying houses and declared themselves the Wisteria Society. The Wiccan League had another name for them, too impolite to record here. One of the first witches was Andromeda Plym, who betrayed Beryl to the authorities, arranged for her darling friend's early retirement. Once Beryl was safely tried and hanged, ensconced in the countryside, Andromeda took over her leadership role, and a Plym had ruled the League ever since. So it was an inheritance that involved blood, just not Plym blood. Charlotte's role as the next leader could not be left in the soft hands of Mrs. Pettifer, who believed in such nonsense as love and quality of life. Miss Plym had instead installed a strict regime of intellectual advancement and psychological repression that would have left boarding school headmistresses weak at the knees. And the results had proven as excellent as her crystal ball predicted they would. At 9, Charlotte had poured a perfect cup of tea while sitting in a different room from the tea service. At 19, she had stolen the earrings from Princess Beatrice's earlobes without anyone noticing. She was the apex of Plymishness. Put a glass or plate down in front of her, and she would be utterly incapable of not moving it, even by the merest part of an inch. One day she would take charge of the Wiccan League, fulfilling the prophecy and allowing Miss Plym to retire, i.e. stay on ruling from behind the scenes until she was at last dragged away to her grave. I should like to see Lottie happy, Mrs. Pettifer said with another sigh. You would, Miss Plym muttered sourly. She reached for a new sandwich, but withdrew her hand empty. Caviar. Really, Delphine, what is it with this nautical theme? Do you not have any good, sensible Marmite? Just then came a banging of the front door, and footsteps hurried across the entrance hall. The ladies glimpsed a grey-clad figure dashing past the drawing room. Charlotte, Miss Plym called, her voice as sharp as a hook. Is that you? The momentary silence seemed to wince. Charlotte, Mrs. Pettifer repeated in a wistful, maternal tone, which is far worse than sharpness, for it can be ignored only at the cost of crippling guilt. Your aunt is visiting. Come and say hello. A woman stepped into the doorway, bright-faced and breathing a little too fast for good manners. My word, Miss Plym ejaculated with astonishment. You look as if you've emerged from a hurricane. Charlotte touched the one loose strand of hair fallen from beneath her hat. The hat itself was tilted. A few creases marred her skirt. I took an unfamiliar route home, she explained, and found myself rushing. Hello, Aunt Judith. Good afternoon, Mama. Won't you join us for tea? Mrs. Pettifer asked. Charlotte hesitated, and the ladies watched her blink as she tried to contrive a good excuse. But failing to do so, she came to sit at the table with that particularly exquisite graciousness which screams reluctance. What have you been up to? Her mother asked, passing her a teacup. Up to? The cup shook in Charlotte's hand. She set it down firmly and smiled. Nothing, that is to say, plodding along as normal, feet on the ground, quite boring, really. Did you go to St. James's as you planned? Miss Plym inquired. Briefly, Charlotte said, and then unaccountably flushed. I mean, only for a moment, just in and out, saw no one special, talked to no one, please pass the milk. Mrs. Pettifer eyed her daughter with concern as she incantated the small silver jug across the table. Are you quite the thing, dear? Charlotte smiled again. Yes, of course. How was your own morning? I've been busy planning tonight's dinner party and making sure Cook ordered plenty of pumpkins for the soup Lady Montague especially loves. Suddenly, Mrs. Pettifer and Miss Plym gasped in unison. Miss Plym dropped the sandwich she was about to not eat. Mrs. Pettifer laid a hand against her lace-swathed bosom. Is something the matter? Charlotte asked, as she anxiously returned their stares. I think you are the one to tell us that, Miss Plym said. Dear, Mrs. Pettifer whispered, you have just poured the milk into your cup. Before the tea! Charlotte looked into her cup and blanched. I beg your pardon, she said. It has been a difficult, which is to say, a boring morning that has quite dulled my senses.
Ahem!
The three ladies looked up to see the imperious form of Woolery, the Pettifer butler, possessing the doorway.
Miss Gluffenbury, he announced.
Miss Plym and Mrs. Pettifer exchanged a glance. Although neither spoke, the former's pained smile and the latter's leaping eyebrows provided eloquence enough. A middle-aged woman sailed past Woolery in a magnificence of lace, ruffles, stripes, and beads. She carried a small white poodle, also dressed within what would have been an inch of its life, were it not actually dead and taxidermied.
Darlings, how lovely to see you, the woman declared. Her voice was so cultured, every vowel had its own bustle and feathered hat.
Her face was a rictus, varnished with the sort of glossy health obtainable only from jars. The three ladies murmured in response.
Although I fear I cannot entirely see you with all this light.
She raised a gloved hand to shield her eyes.
How brave you are to keep your drawing-room curtains open. Alas, my own complexion is too refined for me to risk doing such a thing. You do use adjectives in the most charmingly obverse way, Maud, dear, Miss Plym replied. Darling, and you? Won't you have this seat, Miss Glufenbury? Charlotte said, standing. I must be getting on. Do stay, Miss Glufenbury said, and Charlotte was obliged to stop halfway to the door, or else be rude. You will want to hear what I have to tell your mother and aunt. Oh? Charlotte smiled in mild inquiry. Yes, I rushed here straight from St. James's to share it. Why, Charlotte was on St. James's Street just this very hour, Mrs. Pettifer said delightedly. Darling girl, Miss Glufenbury stretched her smile to show fretfulness. How could you? I say, however could you do it? Charlotte said. Surely everyone knows St. James's Street is not the place for nice ladies after noon. She looked about the company for agreement, although showed no actual interest in the results. All those gentlemen's clubs corrupt the feminine soul. Nonsense, Miss Plym interjected. In fact, she agreed about the unsuitability of St. James's Street for lady pedestrians, but Miss Glufenbury might have said Plym's were equal to Queen's, and she'd have declared it nonsense. The two ladies had been in dispute ever since attending a soiree in the same dress. That is, not together in the same dress, which would have represented a whole different kind of rivalry, but each in a copy of the others, and for the past several years had only refrained from maiming each other by instead using charities in a proxy war of spiteful generosity and benevolence. That it had inadvertently led to lives being saved, and each lady being awarded medals, was a consequence neither regarded, except to ensure their next donation was even more medal-worthy than the others had been. Miss Plym produced from a secret pocket a red-handled device from which she extracted a tiny broom and proceeded to sweep imaginary crumbs from the tea-table. This both calmed her feelings and gave her an excuse not to look at Miss Glufenbury. I believe a modern, independent woman should go wherever she pleases, she lied. Including into the air? Miss Glufenbury asked. Miss Plym's broom flicked a teaspoon from the table. Well, of course not that. One cannot condone piratic behaviour. Exactly, darling, which is why I came at once to tell you. Suddenly, Charlotte coughed. Miss Plym looked up in time to see a bronze statuette on the mantelpiece behind Miss Glufenbury become liberated from its position and speed toward the lady's head. Only a heroic dash by Woolery, who grabbed the statuette mid-flight, prevented the lady from being brained. I do beg your pardon, Charlotte said. That's all right, dear, Mrs. Pettifer replied, smiling at her daughter. Who amongst us hasn't accidentally coughed the incantation? As I was saying, Miss Glufenbury continued, patting her dog peevishly, I was on my way to the haberdasher's to steal a new ribbon for Barker here, when my passage was diverted by a terrible traffic accident on King Street. Pumpkins broken all over the road. Mrs. Pettifer ejected from her chair in shock. Egads, that is indeed terrible. Pumpkins, are you certain? I'm sure even Miss Glufenbury can identify pumpkins, Miss Plym said, although the compliment was so tinged with doubt as to make it clearly, but deniably, an insult. Miss Glufenbury deigned to ignore this. I'm afraid the news gets worse, Delphine. A rather formidable-looking pirate chap could be seen nearby, talking to... Again Charlotte coughed. Woolery rushed across the room and, thanks to a nimble leap, caught a large ornamental wreath that was wheeling from the wall toward Miss Glufenbury's back. It seems you could do with a pastille, darling, the lady murmured. Forgive me, Miss Glufenbury, Charlotte replied. Won't you sit down and have some tea? Perhaps tell us where you bought that lovely hat. In a moment, dear, after I have finished sharing my news. Where was I? I cannot recall, Miss Plym said, but I have a suggestion as to where you might go. Miss Glufenbury's smile tightened to such a degree there was some danger of her face snapping back in on itself. No doubt on the morrow, several impoverished factory workers would have their rent paid for them, and Miss Plym would be scrambling to devise an even more beneficent counter-assault. A pirate was talking too, Mrs. Pettifer prompted.
Ah, yes. Talking to a policeman, can you believe it? Apparently a bicycle had been stolen in the middle of the kerfuffle, and this pirate was being interviewed as a witness.
Was he arrested? Charlotte asked casually.
One can only hope, darling, but I have not yet told you the most shocking information of all. That bicycle took flight over the street, as seen by dozens of people, and being operated by none other than...
Charlotte cleared her throat, and immediately Woolery leaped onto a sofa behind Miss Glufenbury, arms outstretched, to catch a plummeting lightshade before it connected forcibly with her head.
Really, Woolery, Mrs. Pettifer murmured, this is not the time to be doing housework. Please go at once to inform Cook about the ghastly pumpkin situation.
Yes, madam, Woolery said.
Casting a stern glance at Charlotte, he departed the drawing room.
As I was saying, the lady went on, this aerobatic bicycle was ridden by none other than the notorious pirate, Cecilia Bassingthwaite.
Really? Charlotte said with astonishment.
Why are you surprised? Miss Plym asked. I myself have not heard anything more believable lately. That woman is so scandalous, even the Wisteria Society fears her.
I heard she stole one of their houses and crashed it, Mrs. Pettifer said.
I heard she tried to kill the Queen at the Jubilee Banquet, Miss Glufenbury added.
Well, even pirates have their good moments, Miss Plym said, nudging her sandwich with a fork.
But she is still a reprehensible scoundrel. Charlotte, I hope you take Miss Bassingthwaite as an example of what never to be.
Yes, Aunt Judith, Charlotte said. Returning to the tea table, she sat down and smoothed the uncreased tablecloth.
I have never seen Miss Bassingthwaite before. What does she look like?
I believe she is a redhead, Miss Glufenbury said.
That sounds typical for a pirate, Miss Plym remarked. No witch would possess such indecent hair.
Charlotte has red hair, Mrs. Pettifer pointed out.
Blonde, Miss Plym corrected.
Strawberry blonde, Mrs. Pettifer persisted.
Miss Plym reached across the table to snatch the tumbled lock of Charlotte's hair and hold it out, causing Charlotte to wince, despite such a facial expression being uncouth.
Blonde. As the prophesied one, Charlotte, of course, has entirely proper hair.
Mrs. Pettifer opened her mouth to argue further. Everyone turned to see Woolery once again at the door.
Mrs. Chuke, he announced.
Darlings!
A woman strode into the room, her orange silk bustle nearly knocking down Woolery in the process.
I have the most astonishing news.
Charlotte sighed, pinching the bridge of her nose.
Listen to this,
Mrs. Chuke commanded so loudly, even the neighbours could have listened were they at home.
I was just in St. James's and heard all about it.
A vase began to lift from the mantelpiece, its cargo of flowers trembling.
The British Museum has opened an exhibition on Beryl Black.
The vase dropped back down with a clink. The assembled ladies murmured excitedly amongst themselves.
But wait, there's more. Dear love.
Mrs. Tuke snapped her fingers and her maid, a pallid young woman with plain brown hair and a plain brown dress, hurried through the doorway, trying to walk and curtsy at the same time. Mrs. Chuke snatched a brochure from her hand and she stepped back, blending in with the furniture.
For a limited time only, Mrs. Chuke read aloud from the brochure. Visit now and see the mysterious amulet once belonging to Beryl Black.
Mysterious amulet, Mrs. Pettifer echoed with gratifying excitement.
It was only recently discovered, Mrs. Chuke explained. Apparently, it is etched with strange markings of an accidental nature.
Miss Dearlove hurried forward again and whispered in her mistress's ear.
Occidental nature, Mrs. Tuke said. She waved the brochure at them, but when Miss Glastonbury went to take it, whipped it away behind her back. I do believe this may be the pendant Beryl made by melting down the bottle in which she found the incantation. It disappeared the night she left for her retirement in the countryside.
Miss Plym and Mrs. Pettifer exchanged a glance. They knew Andromeda Plym had stolen that pendant from Beryl, then promptly lost it by being so foolish as to put it in a safe place where no one could find it, including, as it turned out, her.
If it is, Mrs. Chuke continued, then this is a tremendous discovery. After all, the original bottle had the spell inside it, and the great power of the sea surrounding it was molten in fire and then cooled in a setting of gold. I've heard it said the power of those forces combined was such that a person wielding the amulet could pull pirate houses out of the sky, uproot forests, even summon buildings from a distance.
It's just a myth, Charlotte said.
It's in the British Museum, Mrs. Duke countered, flapping the brochure.
Never before had a moment of silence sounded so loud.
Imagine being able to weed one's yard without effort, Miss Glastonbury said dreamily.
Or bring a bank to oneself, Mrs. Pettifer said with a smile. Grand larceny from the convenience of one's own doorstep.
Imagine being the downfall of those revolting Wisteria Society ladies. Literally, Miss Plym added, through a mouthful of oyster savory.
Everyone sighed.
The museum's Grenville Library has been remodeled for the special purpose, Mrs. Duke reported, and extraordinary security measures are in place.
The ladies laughed. Even Woolery smirked.
Well, now,
Miss Glastonbury tucked her taxidermied dog under her arm so as to more easily straighten her gloves.
This has been lovely, darlings, but I must be on my way. I've suddenly recollected another engagement I have with my hatmaker.
Miss Plym pushed back her chair and rose.
I too must go. Thank you for tea, Delphine, but I have an urgent dentist appointment that quite slipped my mind.
The two ladies raced each other to the door as fast as decorum and heavy dresses would allow.
Heavens, is that the time? Mrs. Pettifer said,
although there was no clock in the room for her to have consulted. She rose, shedding biscuit crumbs from her flounced skirt.
Excuse me, Mrs. Chuke, but I have to see a woman about a pumpkin.
Not at all, Mrs. Chuke replied, backing from the room even as she spoke.
I only called in to share the information, and now must hurry along myself before...
She blinked at the window, as if seeking inspiration.
Yes, before night falls.
With a swish of skirts and a clatter of heels, the ladies departed, and a moment later could be seen hastening along the street behind Mrs. Glastonbury and Plym toward Bloomsbury, where in addition to the British Museum, there was no doubt a dentist, a pumpkin supplier, a hatter, and several more hours of daylight. Charlotte sat for a moment in thoughtful stillness, then leaned back in her chair, propped her feet up on another chair, and selected a custard tart from the tea table.
Will Madam be staying at home this afternoon?
Woolery asked from the doorway. They exchanged a look.
Neither smiled, although only at the cost of some effort. I believe I might go out in a short while, Charlotte said.
Can I bring you anything for your purpose?
Yes, please. Tell Bagshot I need a new purse. And you might bring me my black embroidered boots, a parasol, 3 screwdrivers of assorted widths, and a gun.
Pistol or rifle, madam?
Pistol, please. I have a feeling things are going to become rather piratic.
How exciting, madam, Woolery said, without intonation.
I hope so, Woolery, for I dearly love a laugh.
And taking a small bite of custard tart, Charlotte frowned pleasantly into the middle distance.
Chapter 3. A Ladies' Man. The Effect of Marriage on Respiratory Rates. Best Laid Plans. The Witch is Back. Two Foes Meet. An Unamusing Destruction. The Tools of Witchcraft. Alex often thought that there was nothing so bad as meeting with one's friends. He seemed so forlorn with them, especially lately, when they were happy to an almost sickening degree. Alex did not believe in happiness. He believed in temporary self-delusion and gin. But as he entered the British Museum, he caught sight of Ned Lightbourne leaning against a wall on the west side of the entrance hall, looking bored, and his heart took him over to the man before his feet even knew what they were doing. That was how it was with him and Ned, that instinct for each other, despite everything. Alex didn't like it, but apparently was doomed to an enduring fellowship, a brotherly kind of love. Damn it. As he traversed the hall, his boots smacking against the polished stone floor, he noticed several ladies watching him. Their heads turned beneath elegant hats as they tracked his calm, powerful stride. Their mouths edged into indiscreet smiles. He heard several whispers and felt hot gazes slide up and down his body. One woman even began to approach, but Alex veered away, having no time for conversation despite her pretty golden curls. As a matter of fact, she was a museum employee, wanting to inform him that he needed a ticket to enter. But as she drew near, it became clear to her he was a pirate, and she wisely decided not to pursue both the entry fee and the scary man with a parcel of weapons beneath his long black coat. Alex did not mind the attention. In fact, after a miserable youth being kicked around and smashed around and thrown various distances, he liked now being an object of desire. He was always happy to dance with a lady, or do a great deal more, even if her motive was just to scandalize society by being seen in his company. He would oblige any who wanted to play with fire. It was never heartfelt, after all. No one engaged with a dangerous pirate for the sake of his personality. And yet Alex had no complaints. Women were decidedly enjoyable. But a good robbery was even better. Any woman he came across today would be no more than an obstacle between him and his goal, the Black Beryl amulet. And Alex intended to obtain his goal. He could not lose because he would not lose. He'd learned the hard way that attitude was everything. "How are you?" he said as he approached Ned. The blonde man glanced up with an expression that seemed all the more deadly because he was attending to his fingernails with a serrated dagger. But Alex only grinned in response. It was hard to take Ned's deadly look seriously after having sat through his poetry-laden ramblings about the joys of love on the night before his wedding. Alex had been able to clean 3 guns and sharpen a sword before Ned was done recounting the qualities of his bride. "Congratulations," he said. 4 months married, and yet you're still breathing." "I can assure you I'm rendered breathless a lot of the time," Ned replied. He sheathed the knife casually in a pocket of his embroidered black coat. Alex noticed that he was dressed piratically in tight trousers and a hideous waistcoat, and it pleased him that his oldest friend hadn't been transformed, not even for the better, by wedlock. "Where is your wife?" he asked, looking around for the woman who had become his newest friend, thus bringing the total to 2. Ned gestured vaguely at a doorway nearby. "In there." "Is that the Black Beryl exhibition? I assume she's assessing how to steal the amulet." Ned gave a brief, facetious laugh. "No, she's ogling all the old books." "And she made you stay here out of her way?" Alex tried not to smirk. "Actually, I'm on guard in case someone manages to take the amulet and escape. I'll stop them and relieve them of their burden." "Ah, you're a true pirate for sure, Lightbourne. Always go with the laziest plan." "Of course. You're here for the amulet too, I imagine." Alex shrugged. "Maybe." In fact, he vowed to never rest until that amulet and the power it contained belonged to him. "Good luck. The exhibition's only been open 2 days, and already at least a third of the Wisteria Society are here, gossiping, trading gunpowder recipes, and sizing each other up for assassination. There are also several other women who I assume are either very enthusiastic historians or witches. Witches, Alex echoed dourly, and Ned raised an eyebrow. Still holding a grudge after all these years. What can I say? I'm Irish. My grandchildren will inherit that grudge, and theirs after them. Then you might not want to go into the exhibition, for everyone's sake. Alex said nothing in a manner as pointed as any of the seven blades sheathed about his person. Ned laughed. I hope you at least have a quick getaway planned. My house is just down the road. Yours? The maid has taken it off to do some shopping. It's fine, I expect to be here for a while. Woe betide anyone who decides to steal the amulet before Cecilia's finished looking through the library. Alex was about to reply when he saw something out of the corner of his eye that froze every word inside him. The briefcase thief had just walked in. She paused at the entrance, an elegant figure in grey, her hair bound smoothly beneath the merest excuse of a hat. As Alex watched, she removed a pair of dark sunglasses and coolly looked around the hall. She was even more attractive than he remembered, and for the past 2 days since their encounter, he'd done a lot of remembering. And restless sighing. And wandering along St. James's Street in case he glimpsed her again, so as to demand his briefcase back, of course, and not to gaze admiringly at her smoky eyes or the slow, promising curves of her body. But upon actually seeing her now, he immediately ducked into Ned's shadow. Not hiding, not at all. He was a big, scary pirate. He just didn't fancy being noticed in this moment. The woman pocketed her sunglasses and began to stride toward the ticket counter. Alex's pulse quickened as he realized she was carrying his briefcase. You're drooling, Ned commented with amusement. Alex ignored him. What shoes did she wear today, he wondered. What terrible thing would they do if she employed them against him? And how could he arrange a demonstration? You'll want to be careful, Ned said. That's a witch. You know her? Alex asked, not looking away from the woman. She had come to the end of the short queue in front of the counter and was waiting in much the same way a stick of dynamite waits. I know of her. She's Charlotte Pettifer, niece of Judith Plym, who leads the Wiccan League. Alex raised an eyebrow in surprise. I didn't know they had a leader. Can you imagine someone trying to do that in the Wisteria Society? Ned snorted laughter. I've heard witches are less volatile than pirates. They both regarded Charlotte Pettifer for a moment, then exchanged a wry glance. I suggest you run, Ned said. Alex frowned. Have you ever known me to run? However, I may just walk with alacrity into the exhibition room. See you later. If you survive. Charlotte was quite certain that the person, be it gentleman or lady, who has patience for a queue, must be intolerably stupid. And yet it was also considered vulgar to move ahead more quickly by smacking one's purse against those in front, so she merely tapped her foot as she waited for a girl to convince the ticket agent she was indeed over the age of 18, and any minute now her fiancé would arrive and confirm this. I am Constantinople Brown, the girl declared in a pompous tone. And when the ticket agent only blinked, I have chatted with Her Majesty the Queen in Her Majesty's bedroom, and therefore obviously can be trusted in your silly little museum. I had breakfast with the Russian Empress this morning, the agent responded with a smirk. She advised me not to sell tickets to lying schoolgirls. Now see here. For heaven's sake. Charlotte said, leaning past the person ahead of her to frown at the ticket agent. She's obviously either an overindulged aristocrat or a pirate. Both possibilities suggest you should let her in if you wish to avoid a commotion. Very well, the agent relented and gave the girl a ticket. She exited the queue triumphantly and waved the ticket at Charlotte. I owe you. Charlotte looked at her blankly. I cannot imagine any instance in which a 16-year-old girl might assist me. Oh,
Oh, but I'm only 16 chronologically speaking, the girl replied, then trotted off on a pair of snazzy yellow shoes that were at least one size too small for her. Charlotte watched with disapproval. Over the past 2 days, she had seen the number of pirates and witches visiting the museum increase as word spread about Beryl's amulet. In fact, some hours, it was impossible to actually see the displayed items beyond all the ruffled dresses and madly decorated hats. At least everyone had been well behaved. Thus far, the only damage done had been to egos, as the two societies engaged in conversational combat while scouting the room and assessing the guarded, glass-domed amulet. But it was also fair to say that if manners got any sharper, someone was going to end up needing emergency surgery. As she looked away from the girl, her gaze happened to meet that of a pale-haired gentleman loitering beside a brochure stand. He was staring at her with an expression so icily intent, Charlotte shivered. His dull suit and shabby brown overcoat suggested he was no pirate. What else might explain the way he kept staring, even after she stared back, as if he wanted to peel off her clothes and skin to scratch at her heart for evidence of...
Fire! Fire! Evacuate the museum! Fire!
Charlotte blinked, her thoughts scattering. A young man dashed through the hall, arms flailing as he screamed his warning. The patrons looked at him blandly. This was the sixth false fire alarm since the exhibition had opened, and nobody was fooled. The young man reached the front doors without effect, and, blushing in embarrassment, turned around and trudged back to the Grenville Library. In the meanwhile, the queue had moved forward. Charlotte glanced again toward the brochure stand, but the pale-haired man had vanished. No doubt he had just been an ordinary citizen, transfixed by the elegance of her hat. She purchased a ticket and made her way toward the library. Over the past 2 days, she had prepared a cunning plan to obtain the amulet. Her amulet. As Beryl's true heir, according to Wiccan prophecy, she was clearly also beneficiary to Beryl's possessions, and while old maps and pearl necklaces did not interest her, an amulet with the power to break magic, break buildings, and subdue even Aunt Judith certainly did. Just thinking of it almost brought a smile to her face. With such power, no one could prevent her from sitting in a quiet corner to read, that is, ruling the league uncontested. So she had stood before glass cabinets, gazing at rows of books while surreptitiously loosening screws in the cabinet door frames. She had located all the light switches. The most significant pirate threat, Miss Darlington, was attending an urgent consultation with her long-suffering doctor after Charlotte delivered to her house a box labelled measles. And several witches whom Charlotte considered rivals had been lured across town by a supposed sale on rug cleaners, guaranteed to get tea and blood out of your carpets. Charlotte needed no crystal ball to assure her of success. Excuse me. She looked up to see a handsome blonde man smiling at her so charmingly, her inner Lizzie Bennet swooned dead away. Instead, Fanny Price arose, tut-tutting. Can I help you? She asked, plimly, which was even more snootish than primly. I noticed a lady drop her handkerchief, he said, but I'm unsure if it would be polite for me to approach her. Would you be so kind as to do so instead? Charlotte eyed the handkerchief he held out. It was a delicate, lace-trimmed thing with pink Asiatic lilies embroidered on it, the sort of confection carried by a lady who had no intention of using it to actually clean anything. Very well, she said, taking it gingerly. What lady? She's in the Black Beryl exhibition now. Pale blue dress, red gold hair in a pure and bright mythic braid. Would you please tell her I think she's beautiful? Good heavens, can't you do that yourself? He blinked his long eyelashes coyly. I'm ever so shy. Do you mind? Charlotte hesitated. Fanny Price advised her not to think well of this man, who was no doubt sporting with some innocent woman's feelings. But another part of her would have everybody marry if they could.
and was imprudent enough to help the fellow toward that possible aim.
Not at all, she said.
He tried to offer thanks, but she was already escaping the conversation before he could smile at her again. Entering the Grenville Library, Charlotte paused on the threshold, taking a deep breath as she tried to assimilate the noise and vehement colors of the crowded room. Almost everything in her wanted to escape to some quieter library, where the only sound came from the turning of pages, but determined ambition propelled her forward. She noticed her mother flirting with one of the museum guards, and Mrs. Chook directing her lady's maid to pick the pocket of a second guard, and half a dozen other familiar faces amongst those crowded around what was presumably the amulet display. Charlotte could not see it past their voluminous dresses, but she could feel its magic tugging on her witchy instincts. At last, she located the red-haired woman in pale blue, inspecting a book open on display and possessing such an air of effortless poise and femininity that Charlotte immediately both hated and fell a little in love with her. Here was a woman fit for a romantic story. And here was Charlotte, tasked with being a servant in that story. Swallowing down an emotion for which she had no literary reference, she strode over and extended her arm, handkerchief dangling from her fingers. The woman turned to regard the lacy cloth with wariness, as if it might be a weapon, and then with gentle confusion. Her gaze flickered up to Charlotte's face, and one elegant eyebrow lifted in a question.
I beg your pardon, Charlotte said belatedly. I believe this is yours?
Looking again at the handkerchief, the woman's grey eyes began to soften. It isn't mine, but I did see such a one in a store window this morning and was admiring it. Where did you get it?
A gentleman in the entrance hall said he saw you drop it, and he asked me to bring it to you.
Charlotte gestured with the handkerchief toward the doorway. At the same moment, the woman reached out to take it. An awkward dance of hands followed. Finally, the woman smiled and carefully removed the handkerchief from Charlotte's grip. Thank you.
He also asked me to convey that he found you beautiful.
The woman laughed. A blush suffused her lovely face. Let me guess, blonde fellow, ridiculous sense of fashion?
Yes.
That's my husband. He's such a rogue. She tucked the handkerchief into her bodice, near her heart. I noticed you here yesterday, also. Have you come up with a plan for acquiring the amulet yet?
Charlotte's eyes widened.
Are you calling me a pirate? Certainly not. I would never offend you in such a way.
Thank you.
I, however, am a pirate. Therefore, my curiosity is professional. Charlotte looked more carefully at the woman. Red hair, easy self-assurance, interesting pockets in her dress.
By any chance, are you Miss Cecilia Bassingthwaite?
The woman smiled again, effortlessly. My husband keeps trying to introduce me as Mrs. Lightbourne, but yes, I am Cecilia Bassingthwaite. May I beg the honor of your name?
Charlotte Pettifer.
She held out a gloved hand, and Cecilia shook it. For the merest moment, their grips shifted in what may have been called, by uncharitable observers, a wrestle for dominance, although the pleasant expression on both faces did not waver. As they lowered their hands again, they smiled at each other with ladylike sweetness. Guns have been cocked less terrifyingly. Charlotte Pettifer, Cecilia repeated. The same Charlotte Pettifer who flew a bicycle over St. James's earlier this week?
Charlotte narrowed her eyes.
That is a provocative question. I certainly hope so, or I'd have to give up piracy and become a reasonable woman.
Are you going to report me?
Cecilia gasped with what appeared to be genuine horror.
Egads, no. We may be beyond the era of mass witch trials, but I am aware the death penalty remains for witchcraft. It would be most ill-mannered of me to send you to the gallows.
While I am pleased indeed to hear that, I feel obliged to mention your duty to the century-old feud between the Wisteria Society and the Wiccan League. For example, look over there. Mrs. Chook is attempting to maneuver a marble bust onto the head of that poor, frail, elderly lady. That poor, frail, elderly lady is Bloodhound Bess, Cecilia said. I am fairly sure her hat will be specially constructed to... And yes, there you go. Both women winced as the bust bounced off Bloodhound Bess's large purple hat and shattered against a wall. It was followed by a dart that failed to impale Mrs. Chook, only by the prompt intervention of her maid, Miss Dearlove, who leaped in front of her, flicking a miniature metal parasol out from a red-handled device to shield the woman. A museum employee dashed over, crying, "No! Not Melpomene!" He fell to his knees before the marble shards. Tragic, Charlotte murmured. What was that tool your associate used? Cecilia asked, with quiet but keen interest. Charlotte hesitated, but could see no harm in telling her. We call it our witch army broom, or besom. It has several functions, although we primarily use it as a broom. For flying? For tidying? Indeed. At that moment, a stiff woman in an even stiffer black dress held out her own besom and, with a flick of her wrist, caused a thin broom to appear from its interior. She marched over and began sweeping the shards of the marble bust with such vigor the employee scuttled fearfully aside. As he watched her work, another witch slipped behind him and, whispering the incantation, directed his wallet to float from his jacket pocket into hers. Teamwork. How fascinating, Cecilia murmured, as if she had just witnessed fairies dancing through the chamber. What a shame that, due to the feud, it would be more trouble than it's worth to invite you to afternoon tea. Otherwise, I'd certainly be eager to have a conversation with you about that device, the elevation of bicycles, and other interesting topics. Alas, I myself am fated to be the next leader of the Wiccan League, Charlotte replied. Therefore, I ought not be talking to you, even now. Otherwise, I'd ask your opinion of Erasmus's The Praise of Folly, which you have been perusing. But I'm afraid I'm required to despise you. And as I see my Aunt Plym nearby, I must bid you good... She stopped, her heart thudding, as she realized Miss Plym was in conversation with a certain tall, dark-haired gentleman whose briefcase she currently held in her hand. Even as she stared at them, Miss Plym's mouth puckered with disapproval at something Captain O'Reilly told her. She looked past him to Charlotte, and her brow furrowed above her little round spectacles. Oh dear, Cecilia murmured. I perceive you may be in trouble. Not at all, Charlotte replied, with a perfectly calm facade. That is my aunt's regular expression of pleasure. And that is Alex O'Reilly she's talking to. Just as I know you were on that bicycle yesterday, I also know he was the reason why. Miss Bassingthwaite, I must venture to say you are far too clever for anyone else's good. Yes, Cecilia replied complacently. So I have been told before. In this case, it is merely that my housemaid happened to witness the scene. But I do understand about aunts, and I know Alex. He's not malicious, but he is, well... A man. Goodness knows they cannot be relied upon for rational behavior. That is true. Charlotte hesitated, biting her lip. I think I'd better... Run away to America? Cecilia suggested. Miss Plym lifted two fingers and flicked them brusquely, summoning Charlotte to her side. Unfortunately, Charlotte said with a sigh, I doubt it would be far away enough. And tightening her grip on the briefcase... She went to face her fate.